Hello, I'm Michael Cantrell, and you are listening to the Prison Officer Podcast, a place to have a conversation about the forgotten cops that work in this country's jails, prisons, and correctional centers. A place for me to try to make sense of a career spent working inside the fence with some of the greatest people that nobody sees or recognizes for the important job they do to keep this world safe. If you love this podcast, hit the follow button, or better yet, share with your family, friends, or coworkers. Hello, and welcome to the Prison Officer Podcast. I guess I'll start with a little apology to some of you that started episode 30. And, of course, that was part one of military leadership books that every correctional leader should read. I had opportunity for a couple of interviews that I thought were important. So I went ahead and did those and posted those before I did part two. So if you've been waiting for part two, here we go. In the first one, we talked about extreme ownership and why that was so important. This one's going to be a little bit different. It's not as much of a leadership book, although there are some leadership lessons in it. But this is a great book for every correctional leader, every correctional officer to read. And it's called Left of Bang: How the Marine Corps Combat Hunter Program Can Save Your Life. And it was written by Patrick Van Horn and Jason A. Riley. So this book, and of course everybody always, unless you've been around it a little bit, you're going to ask, what is left of bang? Well, in life is along a timeline. And when events happen, and bang, you know, for military is when something, a critical incident happens. You know, maybe they take fire, maybe there's an explosion. That's the bang along that timeline. Well, everything leading up to that bang is left of bang on the timeline, if you're picturing it in front of you. And then everything to the right of it is what occurs after the bang. So why is it so important to be left of bang? Well, in the prisons, we try to do this all the time. We're constantly with our emergency preparedness officers or our policies trying to prepare ourselves for what would be a bang in our profession. And in our profession, that could be a use of force in a cell extraction. It could be a disturbance. It could be a hostage situation. Any of those could be the bang on our timeline. And what we want to be is proactive. We want to prepare and keep those things from happening in our prisons. If we aren't proactive, or if we can't get ahead of some of this stuff, then we're going to be reactive. And as you guys know, reactive is not where you want to be. It doesn't allow you planning. You're letting someone else determine, you know, your next responses, and you're letting someone else determine what your response is going to be to this. So why is being proactive so important? Because proactive gives us the initiative. It allows us to stop stuff before it happens. You know, you see two groups of inmates, you know, that are rival gangs and they're headed for the same area. Well, being proactive and getting down there and shutting the gate between those two and keeping them from getting to each other, you know, on a yard or something, that might be an example of how we're proactive and how the initiative allows us to control the narrative there. Whereas if they were able to, you know, get to each other, now we've got a large disturbance, and that could bring in other gangs, it could bring in other inmates. Of course, it's going to cost us money, could lead to a disturbance. And then all of that is us being reactive. We're responding to what they do. And that's what this book, Left of Bang, is about. It's about how to be ahead of the bang, how to be left of the bang. You know, using your instincts, learning to visualize certain behaviors in humans that tell you something might be getting ready to happen. And I'm going to go to the book here. I think this, they have an example here, and I think this is a good example that kind of gives you an idea of what this book's talking about. So this is from one of the chapters in the book, and it says, Dean was a customs agent at Port Los Angeles, Washington, and was an inspector for people crossing into America on a ferry from Victoria, British Columbia on December 14, 1999. Just before 6 o'clock p.m., she approached the last car she was to inspect that day. As she took the driver's license and passport from a man she believed to be Benny Norris, she immediately realized something was wrong. There was something about Norris that Dean later described as hinky. She couldn't figure out exactly what was wrong, but he wasn't acting like the other people she'd inspected throughout her career. As she asked fairly simple and straightforward questions about where he was going and how long he planned on staying in the country, he became extremely fidgety and jittery, began to sweat, and seemed unnecessarily anxious. There was something not quite right about Norris, or the way he was moving around inside his car. Because of the man's suspicious behavior, Dean conducted a search of the rented 1999 Chrysler 300M, which should have been fairly simple because it was already searched as it was loaded on the ferry in British Columbia. As she went through the trunk of the car with the help of some other inspectors, she found many green plastic bags filled with a powdery substance underneath the cover of the spare tire compartment. There were also some black boxes, two pill bottles, and two jars with brown liquid in them. The first assumption was that Norris was trying to smuggle drugs into the country. The plan was to confront Norris with what they'd found, and as one inspector began to guide him to his car, Norris shuddered. Before they got to Norris's car, he took off running into the Port Los Angeles parking lot. When they finally detained him, it didn't take long for the customs agents to learn his real name was not Benny Norris, and those weren't narcotics in his car trunk. The person they caught on December 14, 1999, was Algerian-born Ahmed Rassane, and the green bags were more than 130 pounds of explosive material. The Al-Qaeda operative was on his way to Los Angeles to conduct surveillance on LAX for 2 weeks and then to execute a strike on New Year's Eve. So what would have happened if Dean hadn't noticed the cues that something was wrong with Ahmed Rassane, and that his behavior was outside the baseline she had established? So that gives you kind of a look into what we'll talk about with this book and some of the things that I think are important. You know, there's nothing he didn't stand up and say, hey, you know, look at me. But in many ways he did through his behavior, through his actions, through his uncontrolled physiology, you know, the sweating and the, probably some breathing changed. He was nervous, pupils, dilated pupils. I mean, these are all things that we get to where we start looking at those when we're dealing with inmates and corrections. And what caused her to actually take the time to search that further? You know, she said something was hinky. You know, well, that was her intuition. That was her gut instinct. That was something deep inside her that told her something's not right here. I used to tell my children when they were very young, I said, your gut will always tell you whether or not what you're doing is right or wrong. You know, if somebody tries to get you in a car and your gut says anything, that's a danger signal, because we're in tune that way with the surroundings, you know, that we get used to and we grow up with. It's not something we necessarily develop intentionally, but we do develop it in our psychology and our mind and our conscience, unconscious. I guess one example that I can talk about that probably all of you understand with this left of bang is, how many times have you stood in the chow hall watching chow, or stood on the yard watching the inmates during rec, and you or somebody else says, man, get your back to the wall. You know, it's too quiet today. And what does that really mean? Too quiet. That doesn't mean that you saw anything that alerted you necessarily, but your gut's telling you, your intuition's telling you that something that you're used to happening the same way every day isn't happening the same. And a yard that is too quiet is getting ready to have a problem. There's a reason why those inmates are quiet. All of them are anticipating something to happen. All of them know that something might happen. Maybe it's already spread around the yard that this group and that group are going to go at it, or so-and-so's getting ready to stab so-and-so. And that's went around the yard. So people are making sure that they don't want to be in that area, which goes to the four pillars of behavior that they talk about in this book. One of them they talk about is individual behavior. And that's when you see someone who's taking up space or who's avoided by others. And that's kind of what I'm talking about there. If those inmates know that this gang or this person's fixing to put a hit on somebody, you're going to see people kind of walk away from that person. They're not going to be in that area. They don't want to be involved with it. And for an alert correctional officer who's watching a yard or watching a dining room, to see an inmate who's being avoided as he walks across that yard is a huge clue. Those of you that have worked towers, I know that you've spent time and you've probably seen something like this before. And that's a huge clue. That's when you get a hold of that yard officer and say, hey, keep an eye on this over here. This is what this book teaches. It's use our intuition, how we use knowledge of the way people act in order to intervene before something happens. One of the other four pillars of behavior is group dynamics. You know, the same group sits in the same area every day. And you know as well as I do, there's always this picnic table that gang sits at. And nobody else sits at that picnic table, even when they're not there. So you look around today, and that's not where they're sitting. And they're over on the bleachers with their back to the wall. You know, that's the kind of stuff we're looking for here. That's an anomaly to normal group behavior and group dynamics. Or maybe you see a larger grouping than normal. Normally, you see a couple of them sitting on the bleachers, and while groups of four or five walk the track, you know, from this one gang. But today, that whole gang is in one spot together. You know, that's a dynamic, a group dynamic that, you know, would cause your intuition to go, hey, I need to look into this. Something's going on here. This isn't normal. One of the other four pillars is the environment. And much like I just talked about, a habitual area or an anchor point. What if you see a group of maybe a known gang and they don't want to leave an area? They're hanging out in a certain area on the yard. Maybe it's near the weights because maybe that's where they're going to do a hit here in a little bit. So they're hanging out by that area. And even though other people have talked to them, other people are walking the track, this group doesn't seem to want to move from that area. Why is that? Well, probably in their brain, that's an area that they've found that gives them the advantage for whatever's getting ready to happen, whether it be a fight or a disturbance or, you know, maybe a stabbing out there on the yard. So be able to notice that the groups and how they interact with their environment is, of course, a huge thing. And then the fourth pillar of behavior that they talk about in this book is the collective mood. And the collective mood is not going to just necessarily be one gang, one group, one person. That's the collective mood for the institution. And anybody that's worked in prison for more than 24 hours knows that the minute you walk in the door, you can tell the collective mood of that prison. Or, you know, you walk in and you could cut the atmosphere in that place with a knife. It's just, it's thick, it's overbearing. You can tell something's wrong. Those are clues. This is your intuition talking to you. This is that gut check that says, get your back to the wall. Notify control. Notify your lieutenant. And I know I've been there. Sometimes you're going to get these supervisors that go, that's just your head. But a good supervisor isn't going to. They're going to come down and take a look. They want to know what's going on in their institution. And so you should be aware of that stuff. You know, Left of Bang talks about recognizing these signals and how we do that. But Left of Bang for corrections also involves, you know, emergency preparedness. This is one of the ways that we are ahead of the curve, that we use initiative. One of the ways that we use the ability to plan to make the outcomes better when something does happen in our prison, because something's going to happen in our prison. There's no prison that doesn't have, you know, disturbances or fights or stabbings or whatever. All prisons have this at some point. It's just a matter of when. And the planning that we do for that is what gives us the initiative when the time comes. We hate having to respond, but if we do, do we have stuff in place to respond with? Do you have an emergency cart staged in control center or your armory or whatever, you know, maybe with some less lethals, with some pepper ball that you can respond and you know, put it down quickly as opposed to trying to find equipment? Do you have a plan? Do you have a plan to lock down? You know, one of the most important things, and I don't know, it seems like later on in my career that it wasn't taught as much, but when I first started, I had supervisors that would come by and quiz me on my keys that were hanging on my belt. Hey, pull up your keys. What's key number 26 go to? And you were inspected to know, because that was the first line of defense against large disturbances or riots or even hostage situations, was your ability as an officer in a housing unit or whatever post you're working to be able to get things locked down and controlled in one area. And I don't know that we still do that anymore. Are supervisors out there? I'd be interested to hear. Are supervisors out there still quizzing their staff on what keys they've got on their ring? Do you know every key that's on your ring? And trust me, I used to have some key rings that had, you know, 13, maybe 15 keys, and you had to know all of them. And if you were in one of those posts where you change posts a couple of times a week, you had to remember a couple of sets of keys. But it's a very important thing, standing there at the door trying to figure out and you know, which key goes in this door while the crowd's coming at you is not the thing you want to do. You know, this I can go through so much in this book, but it is a lot of different lessons on people, proximics, intuition. So if you get the chance, grab this book. It's almost like a workbook to me. I mean, there, each of these chapters, you can find lessons that you can practice not only at work, but when you're not at work, that will just make you more intuitive, that will just help you to understand people and how they work and how they work in their environment and around other people. A lot of it you're going to find out that you know if you've been in corrections for a while because you've developed some of these skills, but identifying them and learning to hone them a little is going to be amazing for you. So get Left of Bang. It's by Patrick Van Horn and Jason A. Riley, and it's how the Marine Corps' Combat Hunter program can save your life. And even though these lessons were built for guys who are out in battle, it's absolutely applicable to corrections. So there's the first book I'm going to talk about today. I've got another book here that I want to go over, and this was probably one of the leadership books that taught me the most as a lieutenant. When I became that shift supervisor, you're often overwhelmed as a shift supervisor. I mean, you've went from running your teams or running your unit, you know, being the seg officer, the number one, and now you're running the whole shift. And usually within sometimes immediately, you're on evening watch or morning watch, and you've got 30 or 40 people working under you. That's a whole switch. There's nobody there to ask a question to. So I kind of felt lost there at the beginning when I started that that little journey as a lieutenant, because there wasn't someone at that point in my career. I'd always leaned on someone a little bit, I guess. There was always that captain or somebody above me, or that lieutenant above me, or lieutenant beside me that I could call and say, hey, you know, how do you do this? How have you seen this in the past where you're running your own shift and you're not able to do that? And so one of the things I learned to do at that time was to reach out and find and identify the officers around me who had certain skills. This is where I learned to work with people. And that's what I learned as a leader in corrections. You are a manager of some things, but the people you work with aren't really where you should be managing. You should be leading them. You're going to have a lot of them that know a lot more than you do. You're going to have officers on your shift who've been doing this job 20 years. They've seen stuff you're not going to see as the shift supervisor. They know their areas better than you do. You haven't worked everywhere in that prison, probably. And so you have to lean on people to help you with their knowledge. And managing them from above isn't the way to do that. Leading them is the way to get people on your team and to move forward and have that shift with few problems, or have that shift that when the problems do happen, you can react to them quickly and get it taken care of. So one of the books I leaned to at that time was called It's Your Ship, and it's Management Techniques from the Best Damn Ship in the Navy. And it's written by Captain Michael, and I probably mess up this name, but it's a Brashoff, Abrashoff. When Captain Abrashoff took over as commander of the USS Benfold, a ship armed with every cutting-edge system available, it was like a business that had all the latest technology but only some of the productivity. He knew that he had to improve performance. He realized he had to improve his own leadership skills, much like I did, before he could improve his ship. Within months, he created a crew of confident and inspired problem solvers, eager to take on the initiative and take responsibility for their actions. And the slogan on board his ship became, "It's your ship." He's got a lot of stories in here where he shows you, you know, what the crew was seeing and what they'd seen in past commanders that he had to overcome. How he learned how to communicate with the crew better. How he created discipline by focusing on purpose. And how he learned to listen aggressively. And let me go to the book here. So Captain Abrashoff says, "Leaders must be willing to put the ship's performance ahead of their egos, which for some people is harder than others. The command and control approach is far from the most efficient way to tap people's intelligence and skills. To the contrary, I found that the more control I gave up, the more command I got. In the beginning, people kept asking my permission to do things. Eventually, I told the crew, 'It's your ship. You're responsible for it. Make a decision and see what happens.' Hence, the Benfold watchword was, 'It's your ship.' Every sailor felt that the Benfold was his or her responsibility. Show me an organization in which employees take ownership, and I will show you one that beats its competitors. Captains need to see the ship from the crew's perspective. They need to make it easy and rewarding for crew members to express themselves and their ideas, and they need to figure out how and when to delegate a responsibility." So that's kind of his take on leading and how he started leading that ship. And a couple of things that I'm going to go back to that I take from this. And this is one of the hardest things for some reason in corrections for a lot of leaders to do. But leaders have got to be willing to put the prison and their people ahead of their own egos. And for some reason, a lot of our prisons, especially as people move up in that rank, the egos grow with them. Learning to let people get the recognition for things that happen on your shift, good things that happen. If it happened on your shift, that doesn't necessarily mean that you as the lieutenant or you as the sergeant, that had anything to do with you. You know, letting go of that ego. And I had a supervisor tell me this one time, and I try to live this way. Don't read your own headlines. And if you don't know what that means, how many of you know the person who comes into work every day and tells you, you know, "Hey, man, I was doing this, and yeah, it worked out really well. And yeah, I think the captain was really happy with my idea." You don't need to go tell other people what you've done or how you have succeeded. And I think part of that is this Facebook, Twitter generation. I think people are used to doing that on a minute by minute or a daily basis. But let other people read your headlines. And think about this. If you hear somebody talking about what they did and how great it was, or someone else comes to you and tells you that person did this and how great it was, which one do you listen to more? Which one means more to you? Of course, it's when somebody else tells you, because it's affected other people. When someone's telling you about themselves, it just looks like ego. It just looks like they're always trying to build up their self. That was one of the things I was told early on, and I try to live that way. I'm not sure that I always do. I'm sure there's people who think that Cantrell has too much of an ego sometimes, but I really try to let other people read the headlines. I don't need to tell you what I've done or what I've done well. If other people are talking about it, then I know that I've done well. And that's one of the things he talks about in here, is just that ego. And he talks about in this book, learning to trust. And that was a hard thing to do. And I was surprised a lot. The more trust I gave up, the more I was surprised. When you find someone who does something well, let them do it. You don't have to do everything. And I think a lot of times coming up, we're working hard, we're trying to succeed, we try to be that person that people notice for our hard work. And then when we get to those levels of supervision, we're still trying to get noticed that way. And that's not how you get noticed as a leader. As a leader, you should be noticed for the overall functioning of your shift, the functioning of your team. That's what's more important. The hard work isn't anymore. Let the people who are good at doing something do it. You don't have to make every PowerPoint. Let somebody else make it. You got someone who's good at doing inspections on your shift. Send them out. Let them do an inspection once in a while. Of course, you got to train them sometimes. Bring them in. Let them sit through it, or go. Let them walk with you while you're doing an inspection. If you want them sitting on an inmate disciplinary team, bring them in. Let them see it a couple of times. And then that's something you can turn over to them maybe. Learn to tap into people's skills. And the only way you're going to find out about people's skills, and I talked about it, I mentioned it, communication. You've got to start communicating with those who are on your shift or on your team. You know, when I was a captain, I would try, and I tried to rotate it so that I got everybody. I don't know that I always did, but I would bring people in and have them sit in my office with me 5 minutes. Just get them in there for 5 minutes and talk to them. And there's a lot of stuff you can find out in that 5 minutes. You know, ask them some serious questions. Learn how to ask the questions that help you and give them the ability to give you information up the chain. You know, one of the questions I'm going to start with is, how's the job going? How are you doing? And then listen. Shut up. Sometimes that's the hardest part, but shut up and listen to what their response is. Find out what challenges they're having where they work. The second thing I want to know is, by talking to them, you know, how's your family doing? How's your life going? And why do we need to know this? And that's because happy employees on the outside are more often happy employees on the inside. Also, learning about what makes them tick. Very few people come to work just for work. I would say, especially in corrections, you might find it more so in maybe some other professions, but in corrections, there's a ton of us, and I was one of them, that came to work to make money and to support my family, to have good insurance, to have a government job that I didn't have to worry about when the paycheck was coming in. So ask them about what's going on at home. I'm going to tell you, I'm not the best person for remembering kids' names, but I did try to. I did try to remember, you know, personal facts about them, what they like to do. Are they a fisherman? Do they have two kids? I may not remember the names, but I remember that they have a couple of children. How are they? How are your kids doing? Everything going good? School? Did you guys have a good vacation this summer? You know, but get personal and find out about who they are personally. And then find out specifically, and this is a pretty direct question. So what do you want to do? What do you want to do in corrections? Are you looking to promote? Are you happy in the job you're at? How can I help you improve in the job you're at right now, if that's what you want? You know, there's some skills, there's some classes, there's some training that might make their job easier. A lot of people don't want to move. You want to promote? Well, how can I help you to do that? What responsibilities can I give you? What training can I help you get into so that you'll have the opportunity to promote? Everyone's going to be different, but find out what you can do from them, for them. So I did, I brought them in. I tried to find out how things were going, where they were working, how their family was doing, how they were personally, and then how I could help them. Now think about that for a second. How many supervisors do you have who came to you and wanted to know how they could help you? They were your best supervisors, weren't they? I know they were for me. And I did have supervisors that did that, and they gave me those chances. They may not have asked me those questions specifically, but they gave me those chances to do something new or to learn something new. So I want to go to the book for just a minute, because I think this section of his book really sums up a lot of what he's talking about. And it's called Look for Results, Not Salutes. Halfway through the exercise, the Commodore flew over for a routine visit to see how things were going and gauge the morale of my crew. He flew in at 1100 hours and we sat in my stateroom for half an hour. The plan was for him to stay for lunch, and at 1130 we headed for the officer's wardroom. "Commodore," I said, "that's not where we're having lunch." He looked at me quizzically and asked what I had in mind. I told him we were dining on the enlisted mess decks with my crew, and his eyes grew wide. "I've not eaten a meal in the mess decks for years," he said. "Yes, sir," I said, "but I'd like you to see my crew. Talk to my sailors. They might have questions for you." Crews complain when senior officer or VIPs are scheduled to come aboard, and they're ordered to clean or even paint the ship in preparation. But we have to be out of sight when the eminence arrives, as though we're not good enough to mingle with the brass. Well, on my ship, the VIPs were my crew. I wanted the senior officers to spend time with them so they could discover how truly talented and dedicated they are. I wanted the brass to start developing the same respect for our people that I had. I escorted the Commodore to the mess decks and straight to the end of the line where we stood waiting like everybody else. Of course, my sailors spoke to him respectfully, but as they had already learned with me, quite freely. They were having an ordinary conversation with an esteemed colleague. The Commodore had never had this experience before, and to his credit, he loved it. After we filled our trays, we found seats at two separate tables. Now, the Commodore was on his own with seven sailors. They asked good questions, he listened intently, and answered directly. I could see from my own table that everyone was interested, involved, and smiling. For me, which was both gratifying and something of a relief. If the Commodore had been a traditional martinet, the experiment could have easily been a fiasco. Instead, he was impressed by the caliber of my crew's questions. He had no idea that the lesser ranks could teach him anything, but one petty officer asked him what he thought about the Navy's leadership continuum, a new training program for enlisted people. The Commodore was caught short. He knew nothing about it. Since the program affected only enlisted people, not officers, he had seen no reason to pay attention to it. Now he realized with a shock that he was totally ignorant about a program of vital importance to 1,500 sailors aboard the six ships under his command. Another boss might have been resentful at being shown up, but again, I had gauged him right. When we left the mess decks and returned to my cabin, he said this had been the most worthwhile experience he'd had in the Navy. So, and that's from Captain Abershoff's book, It's Your Ship. There's just a lot of stories and a lot of leadership insight there about how to lead. And I'm going to say about how to lead the way I like to lead. And that is making sure that I'm listening and that I'm learning from the people around me as much as from the people above me. We often, as leaders, as we move up through those ranks, we get too tied up about learning from the people above us. And yes, there's a lot to learn there. You know, they're teaching you, they're bringing you up, you have a new job, it puts you in a different position with new responsibilities, new things that you need to be aware of. But 9 times out of 10, you'll find out that those people around you, and I'm not going to say below you, because when I was a lieutenant, I didn't feel like anybody was below me. I felt like I was the team leader on a team and that I was doing my best to move us forward. And I felt the same way as a captain, just being a team leader. So I probably learned more about being a captain from those around me on my team than I did from those above me. Those above me would throw me a stack of papers and say, "Hey, you need to learn this." Those around me knew a lot about how to do the jobs, how to fill out the reports, how to put together the spreadsheets, how to figure the custodial complement. I learned that from the people around me. The only thing I had to work on was learning to be a leader, learning to be a good leader, not a micromanager, not a boss, not a bad leader. I had to learn how to be a good leader for them. So if you get the chance, I think that book, It's Your Ship, he talks a lot about getting that team, bringing them together, finding out what their skills are, finding out what they're the best at, and then you letting them do that, letting them do what they're good at. And if you want to have happy team members, that's the best way to do it. Let them excel. Let them do what they're good at. You know, forcing somebody, and there's times when we're going to have to put people in positions that they don't want to be. But if you're letting them excel in other areas, they're going to take those new challenges, you know, as just another part of the job. But people that get the chance to excel, people that get the chance to show their abilities are generally happy people. And I think you'll agree with me. If not, by all means, drop me an email. So that kind of covers what I wanted to talk about with military books that every correctional leader should read. The first one on part one was Extreme Ownership. Learn how to take ownership as a leader for everything that's going around you up and down the chain. That one was written by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. The second one is more of a skills-oriented book. It's called Left of Bang, How the Marine Corps Combat Hunter Program Can Save Your Life by Patrick Van Horn and Jason Riley. And that's going to teach you, and I would, and after I got done reading this, I would pass it around to others on my team, especially those who are working in areas like the yard, like a tower, like a housing unit, those places where they really need to be aware of human actions and reactions. That's a great book, Left of Bang. Pass it on to them. And then the final book I wanted to talk about is Management Techniques from the Best Damn Ship in the Navy. It's Your Ship by Captain D. Michael Abershoff. I really hope when I meet him someday that he doesn't say, boy, you just screwed up my name. But that book there, that's for the leader in you. That's learning how to lead. That's learning how to build a team that can handle anything. If you build a skilled team who's flourishing and who's growing and who's happy, it allows you to go any direction that you need to. It allows you as a prison supervisor to respond to anything that you need to, it allows you to build a good shift, a good cert team, a good prison. Take a chance, take a look at those three books. Those are, my opinions on something that every correctional leader should be reading. And until next time, have a nice day. If you enjoy these podcasts, the best way to support the Prisoner Officer Podcast is to share these episodes with your friends or family on social media. Let me invite you to visit www.theprisonofficer.com. If you haven't already, check out the Prison Officer Podcast on Facebook and click that little follow button, or leave us a message, or better yet, leave us a review. And if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, Google, or Spotify, please click the subscribe button. Till next time, I'm Mike Cantrell. Watch your back, and please take care of each other out there behind those walls.